Facebook with Positively Revolting. You can find us at facebook.com/positively revolting. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Positive Revolt. You can email us positivelyrevolting@gmail.com. And with that, we are out of time.
Right on.
Thank you, Teresa. Thank you, Matt, for joining us this morning and getting this information out there. Much success.
You rock.
Thank you.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 9:01 a.m. Coming up on Political Perspectives, host Per Fogering speaks with economist Richard Wolff, author of Occupy the Economy and Democracy at Work, about Greece, Europe, austerity, and neoliberalism. At 10, Air Cascadia is off today, and we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on the Radio Zine, we hear a workshop hosted by activist and author Ajamu Umi on American Identity and Structural Racism and Violence, recorded at In Other Words Bookstore. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you aren't a KBOO member, you can remedy that at kboo.fm. Just click where it says Donate Today. Keep it locked right here. Stay tuned for Political Perspectives with Per Fogering.
Well, good morning. This is Political Perspectives, and my guest is Richard Wolff, economist and professor at Professor Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and a visiting professor at the New School University in New York, and author of Occupy the Economy, among other books. Richard Wolff, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much, Per. Glad to be here.
Well, you know, this is a kind of an interesting anniversary this week. It's the 100th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Haiti. And one of the things that the U.S. did is they apparently they seized the Haitian gold and carted it off to banks in New York. And they took over the customs offices, and they kind of ran the economy to pay off debts to the banks. And Haiti had these debts ever since they won their independence. They were they were sort of given the task of repaying these former slave masters for their lost slaves, and they had this debt. It lingered for years and years and years and years, crippled the Haitian economy. And so in my opinion, the during the 1800s, the ferocity that the self-styled international community had towards Haiti was just, it was really amazing. I mean, and now we see a little bit of that being inflicted on the Greeks. So with that in mind, let's talk about the situation that Greece is in right now.
Okay, let's do that. The basic situation of the Greeks has to be explained sort of in the history of how it got into the current situation. Greece, like many other countries, it is in no way unique in this, finds itself always in a kind of perplexing situation. It's a small corner of the European economy. Greece relates to the rest of Europe, I don't know, the way Delaware or Rhode Island relate to the rest of the United States. Too small to basically shape what's going on, and very dependent on interactions with the rest of Europe, like those states are with the rest of the United States. And over time, the politicians in Greece, unfortunately, like their counterparts in the state houses across the United States, or for that matter in Washington too, display a certain kind of behavior. Let me describe it. On the one hand, they face big corporations and the rich people that sit at the tops of big corporations, and those people want the government to do a great deal for their businesses and for them personally, and at the same time, they don't want to pay the taxes that required for the government to do that. On the other hand, there's the mass of people. They, too, would like the government to do things for them, and they don't want to pay taxes either. This is a non-tenable arrangement. It's the way we organized our society, and so we, in the end, have the responsibility to fix it, but we haven't. And so in Greece, in the United States, and elsewhere, we get one politician after another who basically realizes, when he or she gets into office, the absurdity of their situation. All of their constituents want them to do things that are expensive, and none of their constituents want to pay the taxes to cover it. So how are you going to solve this problem? Well, if you're a very honest, forthright politician, and unfortunately those are relatively scarce, you go to the people and you explain this situation. You say that you can't do the things everybody wants unless people pay taxes. Whereupon there's a great deal of squabbling about who's going to get what services from the government and who's going to pay what part of the taxes in the cost. And in that squabbling, the politicians get roundly dissed by everybody because in the end, nobody wants to pay the taxes and everybody wants the services. Long ago, the politicians who faced this craziness figured out the solution. And the solution is borrow the money. If you're the politician, if you're the government leader, here's how you pay for the services everybody wants without taxing them. You borrow the money. And for corporations and the rich, there's a kind of extra benefit in this. Not only do they save the taxes that they might otherwise have had to pay, and after all, corporations and the rich are the ones for whom paying taxes would be the easiest, economically speaking, but they get this extra boost because the government comes to them when it borrows money, because they're the ones from whom the government mostly borrows the money that it raises in this way, since corporations and the rich are really the only ones in most societies with the money to lend to the government. So if you're a corporation or a rich person, basically what you're looking at is a situation in which politicians, instead of taxing you, come and borrow the money from you that they otherwise would have taxed. This, of course, is great for the politician. They can then deliver services without raising taxes. We are replete in this country, as the Greeks were, with politicians who ran around, patted themselves on the back by saying, see, aren't we wonderful? We lowered your taxes, or we didn't raise your taxes, and meanwhile we're delivering services. The little game that lies behind this, which was always out in the open if you were willing to look at it, was that the country, in this case, the government, the politicians that we're talking about, borrow and borrow and borrow, and the debts go up. For the politicians in this crazy system, this doesn't matter, because by the time the debts come due, they hopefully will have risen to higher office, and they will not be held to account for the debts they incurred. They will have, in a simple way, gotten the benefit, political popularity, without paying the cost. That will be the problem of the next politicians. This was done in Greece with about the same, or maybe a bit more gusto, than it is done by all politicians everywhere. And that would have continued for another bunch of years, as it had continued for 20 or 30 before 2008. But unfortunately, in 2008, global capitalism crashed. We're still in the economic aftermath of all of that. But for Greece, it was a really bad scene, because suddenly their economy really went into a nosedive. Greece is dependent on shipping, and the crash of 2008 meant that world trade came almost to a halt. Greece is a destination for upper-income and middle-income people looking for a vacation in Europe, and that kind of dried up because people didn't have the money, and if you were pinched, one of the first things you cut back is tourism, taking a vacation, et cetera, et cetera. So their economy was hammered, and they faced the following dilemma. We can't pay back our debts. We have borrowed too much. We might have been able to keep this game going for another few years if the economy had been okay, but it isn't. And so we need some help here. We've gotten ourselves into a situation we can't really get out of without some external help. For Americans listening, you know, this is really no different from Detroit or Cleveland or Camden, New Jersey, or right now, for example, Puerto Rico. All of these cities and regions have had very similar situations to the one I'm describing in Greece. But now things get really dicey. The Greeks are part of the European Union. That is, they are part of the unification drive that has gripped Europe for the last 25, 35 years. It's a movement inside of Europe to create there the United States of Europe as a comparable entity to the United States of America, our country. And they are doing that under the pressure of what happened to them in the 20th century, when the Europeans went to war against one another twice, World War I, World War II, some of the most devastating wars the world has ever seen, in which that continent ripped themselves apart. And they came to the conclusion that maybe if they unified, they wouldn't do that to each other. And that was the plan, and it was particularly targeted to control Germany, since Germany was and is today the largest economic unit, the richest country, and the largest by population within Europe. And they were the active ones that were thought to have caused World Wars I and II. That's not really fair. The Germans didn't do that by themselves, but they certainly bear but a good chunk of the blame. So this was a plan to get unity, to overcome the problem with Germany. And if you're going to go in that direction, and if one of the countries in your area has a problem, for example, Greece, well, then the rest of Europe has to kind of get together, led by Germany, to help this part of your country, your unified area, because if you don't do that, and even more strongly, if you are harsh and bitter in rejecting the calls for help, you're not doing the effort at unification any great favor. In fact, I would say that over the last 6 months, since January when the new government in Greece was elected, but particularly in the last month, the unification of Europe and the integration of Germany as a non-aggressive part of that continent has been dealt a setback from which it is not clear that they can recover. That's how bad it is. The Germans led the rest of Europe The rest of Europe went along with the Germans, although they're now having second thoughts, many of them, particularly in Spain and Italy. But for a while, they went along with the Germans, who basically told the Greeks, tough on you. You borrowed too much. We're not going to help you. We are not going to relieve you of your debts. We are not going to enable you to rebuild your economy. We basically don't care what happens to you. We don't even care whether you stay in the new unified Europe. The phrase that came to be used, known as Grexit, G-R-E-X-I-T, was the exit of Greece. And that was clearly proposed by the finance minister, the minister in Germany, who basically speaks both for the German government and for much of the European political structure that the Germans now shape and control and lead. And so you have a situation, it would be the equivalent of the United States as a society basically telling the people of Detroit, we don't care what happens to you. Why don't you go and join Canada or forget it? We're not taking you seriously, and we're not about to do that with Cleveland either, or with Camden, New Jersey, or with Pittsburgh, or Youngstown, Ohio, or any of the other places one could list in such a name. So the Greeks made it crystal clear they want help, they need help, they're willing to suffer. By the way, they already have. Just to give you an example, average salaries in Greece today are about 40%, 40, lower than they were in 2010. Most people listening to this program could not imagine what life would be like if everybody around you, as well as yourself, were asked to live on 60% of what you earned 4 or 5 years ago. Pensions have been cut. Public services have been savaged. People are living on less food. Access to medicines is impossible. When the Greeks, in anger about how they were being treated and separated out from the rest of Europe, had a referendum at the beginning of July this month, they voted overwhelmingly that they were angry and they did not want to be treated this way. They did not believe that their government should cave in and accept the need to pay off all these crazy debts. And the government that was the beneficiary of this overwhelming vote literally a week later collapsed because the rest of Europe, again led by Germany, cut off the flow of money. Since Greece uses the euro, like all the countries in the eurozone, they were basically being starved out, like an old siege battle in which the army that's trying to win starves a city or a state out by not letting food in, not letting medicine in, until the people have to capitulate or else die. The Greek economy over the last 3 or 4 months has basically been subjected to this kind of financial siege and caved in despite the majority opinion of its citizens, which means that the democratic statement of what the Greeks need and want was simply disregarded by the German and other European leaders savaging that country. And so it is a very, very serious situation. Most economists who look at the economics of it will tell you, and this, by the way, includes the International Monetary Fund, which sat with the Germans to do this to Greece. They since have issued a report saying there is no way that the economy of Greece, under the current conditions, both in and out of Greece, can ever pay those debts. It is simply not possible. And therefore, to subject the country to the kinds of pressures that have been put on them to pay these debts and to try to survive as an economy is asking a society to do something it cannot do, and that can only produce anger, bitterness, suffering, resentment, and a whole list of other horrors that make the prospect of European Union very, very dim. So, I mean, I'd be glad to talk about any aspect of this, but we're talking about a situation that is shaking a major part of the world economy, namely Europe, and that will have serious reverberations and consequences for years to come.
Well, didn't the banks like Goldman Sachs and push some pretty shady loans on Greece in the first place? And kind of diddle with their financial statements?
Right. When the politicians borrow, to go back to my story of how Greece got itself into this mess, when the politicians borrow, there are, of course, people who raise an alarm, who are able, even if they can't understand the crazy system our capitalist way of organizing politics and economics is at the root of why this craziness happens, there are at least political and economic observers who raise the alarm, oh my goodness, our government is borrowing too much money. The same way in a corporation, there'll be people on the board of directors who say, wait a minute, we're borrowing too much money. Or members of a family saying to Papa or Mama or whoever's responsible, we're borrowing too much money. So yes, there were people who began to say about the Greek government, since it was the borrower in question in this story, you're borrowing too much. And so the Greek politicians found themselves in a new pickle. Borrowing was their way out of a mess, but now the borrowing itself was becoming a liability politically. So then they were approached, in this case, you're quite right, by the agents of Goldman Sachs, the major investment bank in New York City, and they were told, we can do you a favor. We can arrange a very complicated financial deal in which another entity is set up that is not part of the government, and you, the government, enter into a complex relationship with this other financial entity. We will set it up for you. We will go over it. Long story short, it was a way for the Greek government to disguise its own level of borrowing so that when finally the crisis hit, what people discovered in 2008, I'm talking about the global crisis, and people began to look more closely, then this device, which isn't illegal, but is a maneuver that effectively hides, except from a handful of people with access to the statistics, it basically hid from the public how much the Greek government owed if you put all of these complicated deals together. So, yes, believe me, not only is Goldman Sachs bear some responsibility for aiding in the series of steps that led to this disaster, but let's remember also that for most of these years, the vast bulk of the Greek government's borrowing came from German, French, and British private banks, as well as from Greek private banks. That's who lent to the Greek government. Every loan ever made by anybody ever has two parties, the lender and the borrower. That's what a loan is. And in economics and finance, there's a rule, and it's called the rule of the prudent lender. A lender is not supposed to lend money to someone who is unable to pay it back. That is because the lender will then lose the money if that person or entity doesn't pay it back. And it is considered the job of the lender to kind of be a reality check on the borrower. We expect borrowers to want to have, golden anticipations of how well they can do and to go and borrow money with great confidence. And that's fine. And therefore, we ask of the lender, and we always have, you've got to be the one who looks hard at the situation, and you can't and shouldn't make loans if the people can't pay it back. And finally, the real punchline here is if you make a mistake and lend to somebody who, for whatever reason, can't pay it back, you've got to bear the loss because that's the way we discipline you. That's how we make sure, as an economic system, that you don't make wild and crazy loans. Well, here's what happened. The French banks made a lot of money off lending to the Greek government. So did the German banks. So did the Greek banks. So did the British banks. Even a few American banks made some of these loans. But once the capitalist system crashed in 2008, once we found ourselves in this long and hard economic downturn that we're not out of yet, and it became clear that the borrower, in this case the Greek government, couldn't pay back, guess what? Those banks all screamed bloody murder. They must be paid back. They wanted all the pain and burden of a bad loan to be borne by the borrower, as if the lender had no responsibility, no need to suffer anything in return. And basically, that's been the position, again, led by the German government, ever since all of this stuff came to be. They have played super hardball, squeezing the Greeks and saying they have to pay. And let me briefly explain what that means. If the Greeks have to pay back all of these loans made by politicians they have long since rejected, politicians who were leaders of parties that are now not even in the Greek parliament, their representations are so low, the number of people voting for them virtually zero. And not only did they have the kind of shady financial advice from Goldman Sachs and imprudent loans from private banks looking to make a ton of money on the fees, etc. Not only that, but let's take a look at what it means. If Greece is going to pay back these loans, it means, for example, that €1 million that Greece needs to upgrade its children's hospital is not going to be spent on that. That money instead is going to be used to pay off a banker in Germany, because that's what it means. Money for the schools, the hospitals, for road maintenance, for you name it in the way of public services provided by the Greek government to its people. They're not going to have the money there to provide those services, because that money is used instead to pay off debts. The Greek people are not likely to tolerate this. What you're doing is you're creating an impossible political situation and conflict inside Greece, and my guess is, especially knowing the history of the Greek people, they're not going to tolerate it, and you're likely to provoke real, serious internal convulsions in Greece that I'm not sure the Greek police or the Greek army will be able to, or even willing to, undertake to control or repress. And since the conditions in Greece are very similar to parallel unsustainable indebtedness in places like Spain, Portugal, Ireland, and Italy, the Greek crisis that we're now watching is a kind of foretaste of crises to come with this difference. Greece is a small, poor country. Italy and Spain are the third and fourth largest economies in all of Europe, and that is a order of magnitude bigger problem.
Well, we are talking with Richard Wolff, economist and author of Occupy the Economy, and it seems to me now, after 5 years of austerity, where is Greece now? Have they reduced the debt at all, or is it still where it was before?
The debt, if you can imagine this, the debt is worse, and the reason is very simple. Austerity as a policy to cope with Greece's problems failed. The people who pushed austerity, the European leaders and the Greek politicians at the time who went along with this plan, and who are now voted out of office because of the rage of the Greek people. The Greek people accepted cutbacks in public services, layoffs of public employees, rising taxes that they had to pay for a variety of things to try to get out of this mess. They accepted austerity in all of its horror because they believed, their leaders, that this was the way to get out of their economic distress. The irony is, because their economy collapsed in the crisis of 2008 and then got worse because the government was paying off its debts instead of rebuilding that economy, the irony is their indebtedness actually got worse and their capacity to cope with it shrank. So they're in worse condition today than they were when the austerity started 5 years ago, which is part of why they voted out of office the austerity, pro-austerity people, which is why they had the big change, the big victory in the referendum for no more austerity, and for why there is such rage and anger that they have had now to accept austerity, because the Germans, leading the Europeans, proved willing to literally starve them out. No more money, nothing. No more money that you could get out of the bank. Nobody could pay anybody else to deliver tomatoes or to go to a restaurant or anything else, because, you know, try to imagine what would happen in your community if there was suddenly no money available, not in the cash machine, not at your bank, and no matter what you had in your account, you couldn't get out more than $20 or $30 at a time, et cetera, et cetera. They were making clear that they had no limits to what suffering they were prepared to impose on the Greek economy. And so the Greek government caved in. But it's all well and good for the Greek government to cave in, but if the Greek people feel as angry, as bitterly mistreated, as betrayed, both by Europe and by their leaders, as they now do, you can pass whatever laws you want. There is going to be growing trouble and anger and resistance. That's why I keep saying, for those who thought seriously about a European Union, you have just created a Frankenstein who may come trampling through your dreams for a union. If I could add one story to show you the historic irony of all of this. Let me take everybody back for a minute to 1953, and you'll see in a moment why. 1953 was a bare 8 years after the end of World War II. Over those 8 years, Germany discovered that it had accumulated enormous debts because of the costs of fighting World War I and World War II, which, unfortunately for Germany, they lost. And they were stuck with reparations obligations. They were stuck with debts to fight the war. They were stuck with debts and penalties after the war. They were like Greece, you might say. And they were having a very hard time rebuilding from war-torn German destruction. Remember the bombs that fell on Germany and the war that was fought on German soil, their factories, their railroads. I mean, a lot of their stuff was destroyed. The young men and women who were caught up in the war were killed or injured or mentally destroyed. They were a wreck. And it's 1953. It's 8 years later, and they basically go to their creditors at the time, the creditors of the German nation, Britain, France, and the United States, and they say the following: "We're desperate. We cannot rebuild our German economy while we're having to use all this money every year to pay debts to you, France, Britain, and the United States. Moreover, at the end of World War II, you split our country in half. West Germany went to the West and capitalism. East Germany became part of the Soviet sphere of influence in Eastern Europe. So half our country's gone. And now you want us to be a good ally in the Cold War. You want West Germany to be the close friend of the United States, Britain, and France, and the enemy of the Soviet Union. Well, if you want an enemy of the Soviet Union to have any strength, if you want an ally of the West in the Cold War to have any strength, then you've got to help us rebuild the German economy, and here comes the punchline, by relieving our debt." In other words, let's be real clear. The Germans asked the United States, France, and Britain for precisely the debt relief that the Greeks just recently asked the Germans and the other Europeans. All through 1953, leading representatives of the United States, France, and Britain on the one hand, and Germany on the other, met in London to discuss this. Toward the end of the year, 1953, they reached an agreement. It's called the London Agreement of 1953. And here's what Germany got. Britain, France, and the United States erased 50% of Germany's debt. Simply said, that's it. Forget it. You don't owe it anymore. That 50% is history. You don't have to pay one nickel of it. What about the other 50%? They said the following. Instead of that being a sum you owe to pay us in the next 2 or 3 or 4 years, which was the original arrangement, we're now going to stretch it out over 30 years. You will have 30 years from 1953, 30 years to pay that debt. What that did is overnight relieve Germany of the overwhelming bulk of what they had to come up with each year. Germany got from France, Britain, and the United States exactly what it refused and still refuses to even discuss with Greece, let alone to give to Greece. Everyone in Europe who has a little bit knowledge of their history knows this story. And it stands there in a kind of mute scream saying, my God, what we're witnessing is a resurgence of a German idea that they can do whatever they want, how they want, when they want. They can ask for everything. They have to give nothing. This isn't a unified Europe. This is beginning to look like a Europe which is considered by its strongest, largest member, Germany, simply to be a puppet, a tool. It's as if you had California dictating to everybody else in the United States, every other one of the remaining 49 states, what they can and can't do, how much suffering they will or will not have to undertake, how they have to take what California itself didn't take when it was in trouble X years ago. It's a non, in my judgment, and that of others. This is a dark, dangerous moment. And for Americans, make no mistake, we have our Greece. For example, the Puerto Rican government announced just a few weeks ago, like the Greeks, they cannot pay their debts. They've been terribly whacked by the economic global crisis of capitalism since 2008, and there's now scrambling all over the United States what to do about Puerto Rico. Detroit is the largest urban bankruptcy in American history. It can't pay its debts. We are now seeing the dysfunction of the capitalist system that we have been talking about so positively for so many years coming home to roost with a vengeance and confronting us with the basic question, is this a system whose negatives may overwhelm its positives, and in any case, long overdue debate about whether it's suitable or an alternative system is where we have to go.
Well, you know, it seems to me that I think of Greece as being something like an abused spouse. And should she just run out when things get too bad, or should she plan ahead on leaving and set up some place to go or friends to help her or whatever? I mean, apparently, you wonder just what the Syriza government was planning. I mean, they some people say they didn't have any plans at all, but then we talk about former finance minister Varoufakis had some sort of a contingency plan that was not allowed to take effect. But what would a real escape plan look like for Greece?
Well, let's review a little bit of that history, and then I'll try to answer your question. I know Mr. Varoufakis. I know him personally. I've done some work with him over the years because, like me, he's a professional economist, and like me, a good part of his career has been as a professor of economics, including here in the United States, and I've interacted with him in that capacity. When he became finance minister, and let's remember, we're talking 6 months, to do something as enormous as take a society like Greece out of the European Union, where it has been now for a long time, given all of the complicated connections, familial, economic, political, and cultural, that link Greece to the rest of Europe, 6 months is just, it's silly. You can't make a plan in 6 months that would reasonably achieve this goal. Having said that, Mr. Varoufakis has now said publicly, and I have no reason to doubt it, that he did what indeed any finance minister in his situation should have done and likely would have done. The minute he took office, he assembled a group of people and said, look, in the event that the Europeans, which we don't expect, but it's possible, that the Europeans don't cut a deal with us that we can live with, we need to have some idea of what alternative strategies might be. Can we leave the euro? Could we go back to our original currency? It's called the drachma. Or could we set up a new currency, a temporary one or a permanent one? And it's your job to do this work and to develop an option or a set of options for us so that we're not blindsided if what we're focusing and hoping for doesn't come about. And he actually went with used a professor, a friend of his, who I also know, who's a professor of economics at the University of Texas in Austin, named James Galbraith, who had a very famous father, John Kenneth Galbraith, to help him, as well as working with a group of Greek economists, very well trained, very well educated, very capable to do this. By the way, contingencies like this are a normal part of government. The Department of Defense in Washington probably has a contingency plan to invade virtually every country on this planet. It doesn't mean that the government of the United States is planning to do it. It doesn't mean that it'll ever happen, but it is a contingency plan because you don't want something unexpected to happen without your having at least some work undone about how to cope with it. So we now know that they did that. But it was decided by their leader, Mr. Tsipras, Alexander Tsipras, the head of Syriza, the elected government, not to go in that direction, even when the Europeans dug in their heels, even when they were being, as Varoufakis has said, asphyxiated by the withdrawal of money, so they didn't have the money, which makes the economy go around. And I think the reason for that is the leaders in Greece. And perhaps they were naive, but I can imagine easily how you and I could have been caught up in this. They did not believe that they would ever be treated the way they in fact have. That's why it's causing alarm bells to go off in Spain and Italy. The Italian government has basically been very blunt, talking about how they believe this was a terrible mistake, what has been done to Greece. You're hearing that also elsewhere in Europe. So we're not the only ones that are saying to ourselves, nor are the Greeks the only ones. Nobody believed that the European leaders, particularly the Germans, would do this. And the Greeks are having to pay the price for not having thought it was possible because they pushed this little group away. They didn't give them enough resources to really develop a good plan. So when the time came and they were finally faced the reality of what was being done to them, they in fact did not have enough of a plan and enough of an institutions in place to make such a plan even worth trying, and so they caved in. Having said that, what would happen? Well, the basic alternative for Greece isn't that hard to picture. You leave the euro. You declare your independence from the euro. You substitute in all the accounts of your people. You'll say whatever you have in the way of euros in the bank, you don't have them anymore. You now have some quantity of drachma or whatever other name you give to your currency. You basically replace one currency with another. Given that Greece is a poor country, and given that Greece has a lot of big economic problems to get out of its mess, my guess is that the value of this new currency would drop like a stone. So, for example, you could probably get 20 of them, or 100 of them, or 1,000 of them for a euro or a dollar, showing that they're not worth a great deal because of the uncertainties of that Greek economy. But very quickly, within a matter of days and weeks, everything in Greece would be priced in terms of this new unit. Let's stay with the drachma, because that was the currency in Greece before the euro. And that the collapse of the value of this new currency would make everything in Greece that's priced in terms of drachma very, very cheap for non-Greeks. An American would begin to find out that traveling to a beautiful Greek island and staying at a lovely Greek taverna, you know, will cost $11 a week, food and lodging included, or something crazy like that. And so you'll see an explosion of money coming into the Greek economy because it has become so cheap. That will be a hardship for the Greeks, because since their currency is now very cheap, they're going to have to give huge amounts of it to get a dollar to buy something American or a euro to buy something European. So for the Greeks, they will not be able to afford much, but their consolation will be that at least they will be able to see a spectacular increase in foreigners buying Greek goods because of the cheapness of that currency. By the way, when you do such a thing, it's called devaluing your currency. And that has been a standard operating tool for many countries around the world when they have gotten into economic difficulty to devalue their currency precisely to make the goods they produce much cheaper and therefore much more likely to be sold around the world and dig themselves out of whatever economic hole they've gotten into. The Greeks would have normally done that had they had their own currency. But because they were part of the euro, they couldn't do that since they don't control the value of the euro anymore. That's a European thing done in Brussels, which is the capital of all of Europe. So they couldn't avail themselves. And so the logical alternative, and that would be part of any step that the Greeks take out of the European Union, would be to reestablish their own currency, to immediately devalue it, let it drop in value, go through a hard time, but see, in, if you like, the end to the hard time in the boom they would expect to come because their prices had dropped so low. Indeed, the people inside and outside Greece who advocate for this to happen, and there are many, both inside and outside Greece, who want this, their argument is 5 years of austerity made us suffer enormously, and nothing got better. The situation got worse. Therefore, let's leave the euro, go back to our currency. Sure, we will suffer, but we can see at least some ways in which our economy can begin to be rebuilt as we have, you know, cheaper goods because of our currency. And so we have something to hope for, something to see. What the Europeans are imposing on us is a destructive austerity, and we have now 5 years of proof it isn't going to succeed. They want us to go through what? Another 5 years?
Kind of like
to
Sisyphus.
Find the same lesson out again? We don't want it. And that debate and that struggle, that's what's being fought out literally in every household and across every institution in Greece right now.
Kind of like Sisyphus rolling the stone up the hill. You know, wouldn't this also encourage more homegrown production? You know, right now, you know, Greece does sort of a solidarity economy is springing up out of just desperation and, you know,
absolutely,
maybe on a small scale. Now, couldn't that be encouraged?
Oh, it is being encouraged. And even if it weren't, it would happen. Because once this, the Greeks are in the kind of trouble they're in, and especially if there's a chance they go to they're back to their own currency, then people are going to find imports from outside very, very, very expensive. And there's going to be, as a result, a stimulation to produce these things inside Greece where you can afford them rather than bringing them in from the outside. In other words, Greece will have to be thrown on its own resources. But let's remember, it has a spectacular climate. It is a very old country that goes back to the ancient origins of Western civilization with Plato and Aristotle and all the rest. They are resilient. They are strong. They work very, very hard. They always have. My guess is you would see an explosion of self-reliant industries and so forth. And I think you might also begin to see, and if I were a German leader, this would worry me a great deal, that In other parts of Europe, countries that are similarly afflicted to the Greeks, and again, I'll list those that are obviously on the list, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Hungary, and others, you would begin to see they might reach out to the Greeks or be very receptive to the Greeks to help one another in their shared distance from what is being imposed on them by Germany and the other countries. There has been talk in European circles of a north-south split in Europe in which the northern countries find that the southern countries don't want to be part of a Europe that's run the way the Germans are now showing they want to run Europe. And they're seeing arguments. You see them now in the front pages of the major newspapers in Italy, for example. Given what we are now seeing, the sooner we get out of this crazy Europe, the better. So they don't want to wait for their situation to blow up the way the Greeks did. They want to begin to move now. And finally, you may also see an emergence in which countries like Greece begin to look in places where they haven't looked so much before for much more help and support. And here I'm talking about what we call the BRICS, particularly China, India, Brazil. These countries, of course, have their own problems, but they find themselves often at odds with Western Europe and North America, at least the leading economies there, the American, the British, the French, the German. And so they might find a natural set of allies to help with their problems in certain ways and to give them a whole new relationship to a large part of Europe. We may be very surprised in the months and years to come as we watch the complex reverberations emerging for what was began as a struggle in a little corner of Southeast Europe around Greece, but which has, as I've tried to stress here, enormous implications and ramifications, not only for Greece, but for all of Europe, and for beyond that, for the whole world. It is very important to the United States. A divided, bitter Europe is a very problematic thing because that was the biggest ally the United States had. And I wouldn't myself be surprised if years from now we discover that strategists working in the United States State Department, looking at what was happening in Europe and the division and tension that is building there, that too played a role, among other things, in reopening a dialogue with Iran that is being argued on the Capitol Hill now, a reopening relations with Cuba. The United States has to rethink where it is and where it's going as capitalism's shiftings around the world literally realign who's who and who's friends and who's not among countries.
Well, right now you have this this economic realignment taking place between Russia and China, you know, this new Silk Road initiative, and it's pulling in India and Iran, and you know, they talk about having a sort of one economic entity, you know, extending from Vladivostok to Spain, and so this is
absolutely
sort of happening already.
Everybody is reacting. Everybody who pays attention and has responsibilities in this area is reacting. Ultimately, they're reacting to a capitalism that is going through a momentous shift. It's one that we know about in the United States because the capitalism that grew up in Western Europe, North America, and Japan, the traditional old centers, where the factories were concentrated, the offices were concentrated, the stores were concentrated, the workers brought into the industries with rising wages because of workers' struggles. That capitalism is leaving. It's abandoning its old centers. It's leaving North America, Western Europe, and Japan, and moving, as it has been doing for decades now, to China, to India, to Brazil, and so on. That is reshaping the world. Capitalism goes where the profits are. And the low wages that they can pay in those other new centers, China, India, Brazil, are so attractive relative to the higher wages won by workers in the West that they're basically leaving the West. And I don't think it, neither in the United States nor in Europe, has there been anything like the willingness to recognize and face what this means and what dangers and risks this global relocation of capitalism, what it entails, in part because people don't want to face that we are dependent on an economic system that works in ways that we don't like, we don't want, and that therefore we have to ask this awkward question, are we stuck in a system, and is the solution to change that system? Because that's, of course, always a scary idea. It's much less scary to vote in politician A in favor of politician B, or send a letter to your congressman or something else that isn't scary and open-ended. The problem is, I think it's too little and too late that's available mm-hmm. along those lines.
Well, here's one theory. We got maybe 3 minutes to talk about it. Paying debts, it sort of requires a certain amount of growth in the economy, and growth seems to be slowing down all over the place. And
that's
so the
right.
question is, if there's not enough growth to pay debts, then debts don't get paid, and debts don't get paid. What happens to banks? What happens to the whole financial system? We've got 3 minutes.
I put it slightly differently. What you want is growth, because then you can pay off your debts by means of using your increased wealth. That's why you want the wealth to grow. If you don't have increasing wealth, then the only way to pay debts is to take the money from the borrowing community and give it to the lending community, because there isn't much growth or there isn't enough growth. That's what we're seeing everywhere, that the payment of debts is now provoking social tension and conflict on a spectacular and growing scale, because we're not growing the way we did. Growth is a feature of your economic system. Either we have a capitalist system that grows enough for us to solve our problems, or we don't. And we now live in a system that doesn't. American corporations, just one factoid, have $2 trillion sitting of assets outside the United States, kept there, by the way, because they don't want to pay taxes. It deprives the government of desperate tax revenue it needs to grow the economy. And it means that those companies are not investing that money in growing the economy. Okay, there you see, in a nutshell, this is a capitalism that is more interested in investing abroad when there's a profit. And if that means there isn't growth, they don't think that's their problem, whereas the rest of society is thrown into convulsions because it knows and it lives that, of course, that's the fundamental question. Do you have enough wealth to meet the needs not only of all your people, but of the relationship between people and the environment, so that we don't destroy ourselves that way either? This system doesn't work, is the conclusion more and more of us are reaching.
Okay, we've been talking with Richard Wolff, author of Occupy the Economy. And do you have a website where people can read your stuff?
Absolutely. We actually have two. One of them is R.D. Wolff with two Fs. That's rdwol2f.com, rdwolff.com. And the other one, Democracy at Work, all one word, democracyatwork.info. Both of those websites will allow you to communicate with me, see tons more of this kind of analysis, and connect to us in any of a dozen other ways, including following us on Facebook and Twitter.
Okay. I want to really thank you very much. It's been a very enlightening discussion, and we should go on some more and solve all the world's problems, but we're out of time. So thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Per, and if you want to do this again sometime, get in touch. I'd love to.
Okay, we will. I think we'll do that. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
And stay tuned for KBOO. I believe coming up next is Flashpoints is coming up next. Always good. Thank you very much for listening, and stay tuned. Thank you.
I'm a loving the old lion, a winner without fail.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the PDX Leo Party, Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian. A birthday celebration for all you Portland Leos with special performances from Sleep of Old Dominion and the Chicharrones, Mike Crenshaw, Smoke M2D6, and many more. Again, that's the PDX Leo Party on Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian, located at 426 Southwest Washington Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Willamette River Revival Sunday, August 2nd from noon to 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park in North Portland. The Willamette River Revival is a community-based river festival to celebrate and reconnect with the lower Willamette River and its cleanup. The Grand Ronde Tribe will host a salmon bake. There will also be tabling by environmental groups, Native American crafts, live folk music, storytelling, and other activities. Again, that's the Willamette River Revival, Sunday, August 2nd, from noon to 7 p.m. at Cathedral Park in North Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. The time is 10 a.m., and coming up, Air Cascadia is off today. We're going to hear a full hour of Flashpoints, taking us up to 11 with the Radio Zine, where we'll hear a workshop hosted by activist and author Ajamu Umi on American identity and structural racism and violence.